Mini episode 1663 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1663. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here, with one of our favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries, my good pal Ben Chu, our FDH Hoops analyst, and we are here, as you might guess at this time of year, to do our annual NBA preview. So we're taking a look ahead for the 2023-2024 NBA season. It will be the first NBA season to feature the long-awaited in-season tournament. We have a couple of international games. We've had some notable transactions in the off-season, and some that may still be pending going into the season, depending on what you believe out of Philadelphia. We have a new number one broadcast team for the NBA Finals for the first time in about 18 years or so, give or take. So a lot of different things going on. I do think that the on-court product, you're probably looking at a lot of the same top teams as there were in the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference a year ago. I think that for all these other areas of change from one season to the next, I think when it comes to the top of both conferences, I think there's going to be that probably more stability and continuity there than in any other aspect of the NBA this year. So we'll see if our good friend Ben Chu agrees. Ben, great to have you on as always, my man. How do you see it? Do you see the continuity at the top of both conferences being pretty strong coming into this year?
Yeah, I think we're probably in agreement on this, Rick. I don't think there's any... I think it's a pretty clear-cut top five or six teams that have the chance to make the finals. There's one or two dark horses outside of that, but if we're being honest, I feel like this reminds me of like a year in like the mid-2010s where it's pretty much either a Golden State Cleveland or a matchup that we kind of saw within the preseason and then was able to come to fruition during the finals.
I would agree with that. I think it's relatively... I'm not sure anything is ever, again, going to be as predictable as Cavs-Warriors every one of those 4 years. But, I think we're at a point now where there is a lot of stability and continuity at the top of both conferences. And, again, a point that we've been tracking over the course of the last couple of years as far as that we were in... We've been talking about this on the show the last year or two. It felt like we were in kind of an overlap period between the 2010s and the 2020s as far as some of the powers from that period of time sticking around. And you do have a little bit of that with Boston still being in the mix, but Golden State, with everything that's happened to them, I kind of feel like, and again, the Denver Nuggets being such a strong champion coming out of last year, I mean, you've got the Lakers in the picture as well in the West to whatever degree. But I feel like we've sort of moved beyond that transitional period, and I think that's why it's a little bit thinner at the top than in the last year or two. Do you kind of see it the same way on that, as far as that we're sort of like full-fledged into the era of the 2020s right now and not as many ghosts of the 2010s hanging around at the top of the league?
I think so, and I think also, too, one of the big things is that I think the teams that have a high skill set or a high talent level are all teams that we already initially recognize. There's one or two teams in the middle that I'd say teams like Dallas, teams like Oklahoma City, teams like, you know, a popular pick. I think a lot of people would say the Knicks are in that category as well. So I kind of feel like this is one of those years that it's very distinctive who the top teams are, who are the up-and-coming teams, and who is just essentially playing for Cooper Flag draft status in the near future. So this is one of those weird years. I don't think there's going to be a lot of, there's going to be many sort of, I don't think we're going to see any major surprises, I would argue.
Yeah, and I think that's true. There were a number of coaching changes in the offseason. There were some marquee jobs that were changing hands. Adrian Griffin takes over in Milwaukee, Nick Nurse in Philadelphia. The carousel lands Frank Vogel in Phoenix. And there were some non-marquee jobs that were coming open as well. Ime Udoka moves to Houston. Monty Williams goes to Detroit. And Darko Rajakovic moves to Toronto. So any thoughts on any of those moves as being particularly impactful? I'm, as you know, intrigued to see what Frank Vogel can do with the Suns. I don't know if they necessarily needed to make a change, but they felt like they needed to. Adrian Griffin now inherits not only Giannis in Milwaukee, but Damian Lillard after the trade recently here. Nick Nurse still has the situation in Philadelphia with James Harden hanging over his head, but Embiid and all the other guys ready to go. So thoughts on any of these moves and how impactful they may be?
I mean, ultimately, the real question is, and I think probably the most interesting status of anyone would be Adrian Griffin in Milwaukee, is how some of the stuff that he learned in Toronto under Nick Nurse and how sort of that offense is going to run with Lillard and Giannis and Brook Lopez. So that's going to be interesting. I agree with you on Frank Vogel, too. That Phoenix team should be good. They have a much deeper bench than they had last season. And it's going to be interesting to see, even though I felt Detroit overpaid Monty Williams to go there, that is a very young, fun sort of team that could make a little bit of noise if they are able to come together quickly in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, they really shelled out a lot of money for the new coach, and it'll be interesting to see. Health is going to have a lot to do with it, because that has been a big enemy for the Pistons the last couple of years. We have some international games this year. Orlando versus Atlanta on November 9th in Mexico City, and Brooklyn versus the Cavs over in Paris on January 11th. And I've been reading some things recently about Paris. Of course, they're supposed to host the Summer Olympics next year. And apparently there's a bad bed bug infestation over there. So here's hoping that my Cavs and also the Nets, if you want to say that, come back free of that, Ben Chu, and dealing with nothing worse than a little bit of light jet lag.
Right, and I think also just to talk about even international games in the preseason. I know Abu Dhabi had two games between the Timberwolves and the Dallas Mavericks. I know this series, the Raptors are playing a couple of games in Canada. I believe one in Vancouver, one the other one in Montreal. So it's the league is, we're starting to see the path again for the league to put on some more international games and definitely see some things with some of the essentially the overseas money going to possibly be discussed in terms of minority ownership shares of these franchises, especially with expansion on the horizon.
Absolutely. And you
I would not be surprised to see some foreign money getting pushed into those franchises.
I think that's definitely the case here. Potentially some of these sovereign wealth funds, there have been rumors about that in recent years. And other sports, of course, following this path. We are, of course, in season for the NFL, where they're playing London games, and there will be games in Germany and other places during the season. MLB having a brief series in London this past summer. The NHL just had, it was an exhibition game down in Australia. So there is a lot of money to be made globally in these markets from these fans. I mean, these sports are basically niche pursuits in most of these other countries. You get to a country like China, which I know you know something about that and that market, because that's something you used to track a couple of years ago through your website as far as the following that it has there. So a country like China, it's bigger than a niche, but other places, it's at least substantial niches and basically places for these leagues to make up nice ancillary money along the way, and these leagues care about nothing if not money.
Right, and I mean, just to make a straight thing, based on, you know, with the games being played in Abu Dhabi, the NBA Instagram channel for that region, for NBA Arabic, has almost 90,000 followers on Instagram, and I think they have over 100,000 on some, I can't remember if it's Facebook or Twitter at that point, but they have sizable followings overseas, and especially when Team USA also went over and played there. They have a state-of-the-art arena out there, and it's going to be interesting to see if they, very similar to India, at some point get a regular season game played in that region.
Yeah, it does seem like it's just a matter of time with some of these locales here for as much money as there is on the table. And there's a tremendous amount of money, of course, in the Indian
market. And I think the league, too, we've discussed this in the past, too, Rick, that some of these other places like Japan and Sydney. Japan had one recently, but also I could see definitely some more games in Australia and Africa, maybe a game or two closer in line into the regions of like Sweden and Norway, or, you know, we haven't seen it. It's been a while since we've seen a game in Germany as well. So
yeah, that's very
possible. I think the league now is probably in its health period of time with international play, and especially with, due to the pandemic shutting down some of the games they had planned, they've been able to recover rather quickly.
Yes. And Scandinavia has been a place that the NHL has played some regular season games, usually the first couple games of the season whenever they do that. So there is a decent following there for major North American sports. That is a possibility as well. A few more quick notes before we take a look at the two conferences here in the shape of things. Of course, the introduction of the in-season tournament this year. So you're going to have a couple of group games, round robin, with the six different groups that are going to be played. You move on from there to quarterfinals, semifinals, finals. And so you will have those games being played. There, whoever makes it to the final, it will be an extra, it'll be an 83rd game, which will not count for regular season purposes. So for the playoffs, for statistical purposes, anything else like that, it won't be the case. But you have a setup here where, in talking to FDH Lounge dignitary Anthony Petrone the other day, a fellow lifelong Cleveland Cavaliers fan, looking at it from the perspective of that, of one of the teams in the league that is a contender and hoping to do something in the playoffs, I would think that for teams like the Cavs, and there's probably at least about 10 or 15 teams in that boat that are hoping to make the playoffs and potentially really be able to go somewhere once it starts, and particularly like the Cavs, if you're coming off a bitter ending to the season the previous year, it would seem like this is a good opportunity to get that kind of practice, that kind of competitive situation here, because I don't know about the group round games, but I mean, if you can qualify for the semifinals, if you can be in a potential to be able to do that, the semifinals, the finals, that would help simulate, I think, the pressure that, again, you know, teams that, again, if you're playing Milwaukee or Boston or Phoenix or Denver or a couple of these teams during the regular season, you may get that same level of near playoff intensity. But I would think that for the teams that are looking to make a jump up in the playoffs, this is probably the best preparation that they could get in those critical games, even if it's basically just bragging rights and what's basically chump change to these high-paid athletes. It still is a situation where the chance to win this thing and get that jolt of confidence that you can go in and beat anybody on any given night once the playoffs start, I would think that it would be useful in that sense, Ben.
Right. And I'm a little more skeptical about how the in-season tournament will work in future years, but at least for year one, I think it's a great way to have, for the league to have a way to have more competitive games in November going into December, because the issue, and we've discussed this forever, that the running joke for everyone in sports media was the NBA doesn't start until Christmas Day. And this will be a little bit of a way to get some early initial attention to these teams and games that the league will be able to hype up on social media or on, you know, on their streaming platforms like Max. It's going to be, you know, I think it'll be, this will be more of a sort of an experimental year one. I think you'll see a lot of teams rest guys. I think you'll see some teams go all out to try and win, and I think it wouldn't surprise me there will be scenarios or games where teams will intentionally throw games just to not have to go play in, you know, in going to a quarterfinals or a semifinals. So I can't rule any of that out, but I do think it's an interesting experiment for the league, and if there's a way to make some of these earlier regular season games count in the eyes of the fans or the media, I think it's a good idea.
This is the first that we're getting a chance to really see any of this. We can kind of speculate, as you said, but we'll get a chance to see what the rhythm of this is and the level of competitiveness and everything else. The other thing here as well is that for some of these tournament games, I'm sure it'll be a little bit of a precursor for the NBA playoffs and finals when you're going to be having a new team here, as you're going to have Mike Breen being surrounded now by Doris Burke and Doc Rivers on the call after ESPN did their big cuts with Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy going by the wayside. So first change in almost two decades to the team that we'll be calling the NBA Finals, Ben.
Yeah, and it's definitely going to be an interesting setup. I think Breen has worked with Doris Burke before. Mainly she used to work with Mark Jones as, I believe, it was the second crew. And then she'd move over to sometimes doing sidelines on the finals team. Breen and Rivers went back to the timeline of, like, you know, I believe they had worked together at MSG for a bit. And they also worked together briefly, I believe, with NBC and TNT. So it's going to be an interesting crew. I think the NBA, if we're being honest, kind of soured on that team of Van Gundy, Jackson, and Breen after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like that every sort of period of time, these sort of championship game announces, whether it's in the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, or the NHL, like you need to sort of change some things a bit. And I think a lot of people, while that trio of Breen, Jackson, and Van Gundy were very polarizing, I think there's a lot of people who had their very staunch opinions about that broadcasting unit.
Yeah, there were a lot of opinions out there. I mean, I myself wasn't necessarily the biggest connoisseur of that trio, but you know, we'll see what these guys are able to do in their stead. Going forward, looking at the Eastern Conference here, as we start to take a look at the standings, I know that heading into the playoffs last year, there was some kind of general sense that perhaps it was going to come down to Boston and Milwaukee in the end. And then, of course, the Knicks ended up getting in the way of that to some degree. Well, mostly Miami, actually. The Knicks taking out the Cavs, who were thought to be one of the potential contenders in there. But Miami taking out Milwaukee and getting to improbably a third Heat Celtics finals in the East in 4 years. And in looking at this year, as I sort of peruse the top of the standings, I've got Boston as the number one seed, Milwaukee as the two, Cleveland as the three. I was prepared actually to slot Cleveland second based on their offseason moves, picking up the long-awaited outside shooting, consistent outside shooting at the three. It's not like the Cavs didn't have shooting there, but was it going to be Chetty's night or not Chetty's night, basically? And that's kind of how it was with a couple of their guys. Max Strus and the minivan, Georges Nyang, are going to be a lot more competitive, I think, from the three-point stripe. It's going to open up the floor a little bit more. But then Milwaukee bounces back and picks up Damian Lillard from Portland, and all of a sudden, again, they seem to be the team to beat in the Central Division. Behind them at the top of the conference, I would say I've got Miami and New York in the 4 and 5 spots in that order. So I don't think you necessarily go further down than that as far as teams that could make it to the finals. Philadelphia is a perennial big favorite out there from a lot of pundits that are so wowed by Joel Embiid. They always think this is going to be the year for Philly to get it going. I'm not one of those people. I wasn't one of those people last year. But looking at the top couple of teams in the conference here, I've got it being Boston and Milwaukee in the Eastern Conference Finals. What do you see the shape being of the top of the East, Ben?
I think it's pretty much what you already just said, Rick. Okay. Barring injury, I'm pretty sure it's going to be Boston, Milwaukee. I mean, both Cleveland, and I think if the Knicks can continue to hone their offense, they will be an interesting team in the mix. We saw Miami lose a lot of key pieces. I'm not 100% sure they're going to have a great year this year. I feel like both the Knicks and the Heat are going to regress a little bit. So the only real question I ultimately have are some of these teams that are at the bottom, some of the younger teams like Orlando, Detroit, Indiana, if they're going to make that sort of mid-tier jump to being a competitive playoff team. That might be the most interesting, because I think you are probably in agreement that I do not really see, unless there's another trade at some point, I just don't see anyone surpassing Boston and Milwaukee at this point to go to the conference finals.
Yeah, and to the point you just made there, as far as the play-in teams here, I've got a couple of established teams at that level. I've got Atlanta at 37 wins, Brooklyn at 38 wins, but I do have a couple of teams making a little bit of a jump up here into that spot. I've got Orlando at 39. I think this is the first year that they can at least start to make a little bit of noise with that young nucleus that they have, especially in the front court. And then Indiana, now I slotted them in at 41 wins. This is before the whole Buddy Hield thing here. We're going to have to see how that shakes out. But Indiana is definitely a team that when you look at it here, Halliburton and Mathurin and a couple of these guys there, Indiana's got, I think, very quietly a core that they're building that is going to be very competitive, and I think a future rival of some of the top teams in the Eastern Conference. Indiana and Orlando, I really think that they are the future as far as joining that top tier.
Ryan, I feel I'm in complete agreement with that. I'd also toss in Detroit if Kate Cunningham can stay healthy as well.
Very possibly, yeah. It will be very interesting to see how that goes. You've got, you know, the usual sort of mid-tier suspects in the mix here. I sort of slot Philadelphia into that at 46 wins that I know a lot of people would find that to be kind of heresy, but that's just how I see it shaking out. There's a lot of uncertainty there at the moment. In the Western Conference, Denver is the team to beat, as they are in the entire NBA, for a team that just cruised through the playoffs last year. Again, you lose Bruce Brown, he goes to Indiana. That's yet another piece in Indiana that I am speaking of here that they have that's really going to help them going forward. You lose that, but you've got guys that you can kind of plug into that. Player development, we've been talking about this for at least 3 years on the show here, the player development era in the NBA, that again, the new CBA is making it more important than ever as far as building out your team, your rotation. Denver and Miami are two of the biggest success stories in player development in the league, so it was fitting that they were in the finals to kick off this new CBA era. Denver is going to be able to fill out their roster, I think, just fine, even with the competitive issues out there with the cap and what it's doing. The fact that the second layer of the cap here is essentially serving as a hard cap, the second apron, so to speak. But Denver, they're still the team to beat in the Western Conference, and I think the NBA as a whole, I think that's a very chalk thing to say on my part that I think few people would probably take issue with. I think their closest rival in the Western Conference would probably be Phoenix, with having added Kevin Durant to the mix here. That guy can always smell a hot situation to go to, right, Ben? But he goes out to Phoenix, and it's a top-heavy group, to be sure, but that's a thing where, again, I'm looking ahead here, and I'm already guessing it's going to be Denver and Phoenix in the Western Conference Finals. I think there's a couple other candidates that could potentially crack the mix, but I don't know that there's anybody that's necessarily that close to either of those two, especially Denver. What do you think?
Right, and I tend to agree as well. I mean, 2 points I'd make too. The one team that I think is kind of is there, but we're going to see need to mesh, is the Lakers. They obviously have huge question marks regarding LeBron and AD because, again, both of them are old and have had injury histories now. So we'll see how they're able to play. The rest of the West outside of Phoenix, the Lakers, and Denver, it's a lot of teams in mid-tier transition like Utah, like the Portland Trailblazers, San Antonio with Wemby. It's going to be interesting to see how the Spurs build around them at that point. And if you just kind of look, I just don't see many scenarios or many teams that are really going to have enough oomph to knock out the Nuggets. The question ultimately we're going to have for them is losing guys like Bruce Brown, losing guys like Jeff Green. Will guys like Zeke Nagy, guys like Julian Strother, guys like Christian Braun, will they be able to make up that sort of extra little bit of oomph as well for that Denver offense?
Yes. I think Christian Braun in particular is a guy that they're counting on. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And also, too, we have to also mention Reggie Jackson as well.
Yes. So there is going to be some work to be done, but again, Denver has been the top-notch team in the league at doing this kind of thing for a while now, and that was one of the big factors, of course, in getting a title, particularly when, again, their franchise player, the best player in the NBA, Nikola Jokic, when he was a second-round pick. I mean, he is the all-time example of player development here, and they've been able to do it at every other position in this lineup. It's funny that, like, when you mention the Lakers, some of the challenges that they're going to have, I do think they have better depth than they had a year ago, but I'm still looking at it like I think they're a team that is going to push over the line of not having to be one of the play-in teams, but I don't think they're going to clear the bar by very much. I don't think that Golden State's going to clear the bar by very much. I've got the Lakers at 45 wins and Golden State at 44 wins, and there's another team in here. If there is a team that I think could give Denver and Phoenix a little bit of a nudge, especially, let's just say Phoenix, right? Denver, all things being equal, no injuries, you pencil them into the Western Conference Finals. But if there's anybody that could take down Phoenix to become the other team in the Western Conference Finals, I'll get to that team in a second here. But I'm looking at Dallas, which continues to be a team sort of in transition that I'm just not as taken with. I think they win the Southwest by default, but I've only got them at 42 wins. But back to Golden State, they're a team that this new CBA was designed to basically dynamite that team. And what's funny is it dynamited a lot of scenarios for teams that are now trying to challenge Denver. But it's basically almost the equivalent of the SMU death penalty that you put on Golden State as far as being able to add guys. Yeah, they got Chris Paul in there, but they are locked into a very, very aging kind of a core there. So it goes back to what we said before about the teams of the 2010s. Not that the Lakers necessarily were, but LeBron, you know, like going from Miami to Cleveland to the Lakers, you know, in the 2010s here, wherever LeBron was, that was one of the teams to beat. But if, as you look at it now, this era of the 2020s where the teams from the 2010s are kind of fading away, I think that the Lakers and Golden State to me are sort of like exhibit A for that right now. Both locked into an aging core, both facing salary cap issues.
Right, and I think at that point, too, is that I don't think anyone, in my humble opinion, really think either one of those franchises is going to sniff the finals this year. And again, you know, we all know that dynasties come to an end, and Golden State still has a lot of young talent. It's just, it seems almost more like that. This kind of reminds me of the tail end of the San Antonio Spurs dynasty just years ago, where everyone started to age. And then injuries happen, and then just things out of their control. And what ends up happening is that this Golden State team is going to need a refresh at some point, like it or not. So it's going to be interesting to see. There are some dark horses that we haven't talked about yet, but I figure we will get to them shortly.
Yes, and by the way, Bob Myers no longer in Golden State. He yes. got out while the getting was good. That's going to complicate things as well. If there is a team, as I said before, that I think could possibly challenge Phoenix to make it to the Western Conference Finals, I'm going to say Sacramento. The tendency a lot of times, especially in the NFL, is to talk about the plexiglass principle, where a team may recede after taking a big jump up. I don't think that's going to be the case with Sacramento. I think they think there's unfinished business. They let Golden State up off the mat in the first round of the playoffs last year. I've got Sacramento down for 53 wins. And at 46 wins, who I've got coming in even ahead of the Lakers and Golden State, albeit not by much, Oklahoma City. You put Chet Holmgren in the mix here. If he can stay healthy, you put him into the mix with the young core that was coming together last year. So these are some younger teams that I think can really make some noise here, Ben.
Right. And I think Sacramento offensively last season under Mike Brown had one of their better seasons in recent memory.
Yeah.
And it feels like to me that if Sacramento can stay healthy, and they've added a lot of good pieces in the offseason, so I think they have an ultimate opportunity to make a little run. OKC is very interesting right now because Shea had a great FIBA World Cup for Team Canada.
Yep.
You're going to get guys like Jalen Williams. You're going to have a full season of Holmgren, hopefully, at that point. So, like I said, it would not shock me to see one of those two teams get past Phoenix and get to the Western Conference Finals. But it strikes me that Phoenix's major issue last year was just a pure lack of bench depth. And I feel like with the roster that they have currently constructed and adding Bradley Beal, they will still have enough to get to the Conference Finals and face Denver. The real question is essentially you're replacing DeAndre Ayton with Nikola with Yusuf Nurkic. And as someone who was, you know, who spends time in Portland, I've seen Nurkic against Jokic, and Jokic usually smokes him. So again, I mean, Phoenix can score with the best of them. The question ultimately is, like, can they stop anyone? That ultimately derailed their team last season. So.
Exactly. And by the way, and there's always something that we can find in what we're saying here that may yield larger life lessons for people. If there's anybody in the listening audience that ever despairs of getting better in a certain area, that ever despairs of finding improvement in things, keep in mind that you just heard Ben Chu refer to Sacramento's huge glow-up offensively under Mike Brown as a head coach. If that was possible, Ben, then it's possible for anybody to improve in any way.
Right. And ultimately, I think the thing for that team is they're going to have to keep De'Aaron Fox healthy.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. you could tell later in that playoff series against Golden State that he was just not 100%.
Yeah, true. And what they've been able to do particularly, and again, a lot of people really thought they got ripped off in the deal where they gave up Halliburton. And again, I think anytime you're giving up Halliburton, it's hard to say you're not the losing end of the deal. But what they're doing there with Sabonis and the way that they've been able to make him sort of like their mini Jokic with how they're able to run that offense, that was a big, big, big key to what they were able to get going on as well. And again, Mike Brown, and let's give credit here, where he picked up a lot of these principles that he was able to use. Ironic on the fact that Golden State took him out in the first round, but that time of coaching under Steve Kerr in Golden State, you see it there. And the Mike Brown that is in Sacramento, I can say very grimly as a Cavs fan, bears very little resemblance to the Mike Brown, especially offensively, that I saw in Cleveland over his two stints.
Right, and one name that I think a lot of people begin to know, because I watched him play in EuroLeague, Sasha Vendenov.
Mm-hmm.
They acquired his rights, and he's going to probably fit into that sort of sharp shooting role, essentially play alongside Malik Monk. And there are some other interesting Western Conference teams like the Pelicans. We'll see if Zion can get healthy and see if that team can kind of make that jump that they kind of looked like they were going to make last year. And then, I mean, as much as I am a little skeptical of the Los Angeles Clippers right now, we fully can't say that they're done yet, especially if James Harden is able to go there and via trade at some point as well.
Right. I've got the Clippers as a play-in team at 43 wins. I've got New Orleans missing it at 37 just because of the questions with Zion. I've got Memphis as a play-in team at 40 wins because of the Ja Morant situation, missing a good chunk of the season here with his self-inflicted issues. And to borrow a concept from what Bill Simmons has liked to talk about over the years of some of the teams that are the best teams to watch if you have league pass, I think that the Western Conference is very heavy in this regard here in terms of you've got Portland, which, again, they're starting over without Lillard, but with Scoot Henderson coming in. You've got Victor Wembanyama, as you referred to, with San Antonio coming in, potentially the most hyped NBA rookie in 20 years since LeBron James going there, and just seeing what happens around him here in what will be the waning years of Coach Pop's head coaching career. That's going to be fascinating. And Houston, now that you have Udoka going there to coach that team and finally bring together some of the young pieces on the team, albeit, again, you look at some of the offseason moves that they made and, like, are they going to have enough room in there for some of the younger guys to play, although Kevin Porter Jr. did his best to clear up room on there, the fact that he's no longer going to be playing for Houston because of his ongoing set of issues. So these teams in particular, these young teams in the West, like night after night, if you've got league pass, or it strikes me that they're probably more likely to show up on NBA TV. For those of us that don't have league pass, we're probably more likely to see them there than on any of the major networks that are carrying basketball. These teams seem like they're going to be pretty fun to watch night in, night out.
Right, and I think also, Rick, we've discussed this off air too. Like, this is the beginning of a new era in the NBA, and I think also too, what's going to happen is that we're going to see guys like Scoot Henderson and Victor Wembanyama. We also saw Jabari Smith take a big leap during summer league. So you got a lot of good young talent placed across a bunch of different teams in the Western Conference. It's just, I hate to say it, Rick, this year the NBA Conference, it seems like we can all kind of predict X and Y teams are going to make it to the Western and Eastern Conference Finals this year.
It does seem like that in the Eastern.
I think the regular season will be very fun, but the playoffs will not be that interesting.
I think it's going to be a weeding out process, as do you. In the Eastern Conference, I've got the one over the two, Boston over Milwaukee in six. In the Western Conference, I've got, what do you know, the one over the two in six games, Denver over Phoenix. And in the NBA Finals, I've got Denver over Boston in six. I would have been prepared to say five had it been for, again, this ripoff trade that Boston was able to make, getting Porzingis in there. And then, of course, they did well to add Drew Holiday to the mix. This whole notion, all these crocodile tears over losing Marcus Smart. It's like, I've never seen in the modern era of the NBA so many tears shed over a guy that can't shoot the ball consistently. I mean, I just, I, you know, but again, they managed to hoodwink the teams involved in the Porzingis trade and basically got him for free as far as I'm concerned. Not that I'm bitter about it, mind you, but I've got that being the key factor in being able to get Boston to the finals, to lose to Denver in six, to be the designated victim out of the Eastern Conference. How do you see it shaking out in the end as of right now, Ben?
I find it very similar. I think we both have the same four teams. I'm going to say, though, I think Milwaukee with Lillard and Giannis will have just enough over Boston. My real question with the Celtics is their, you know, their front court depth, to be honest, Rick, with all these trades, is not great.
Yeah.
You're essentially putting it down to a 37-year-old Al Horford and a Porzingis who has never been consistently healthy. So,
yeah,
I think that's going to be kind of their weakness against a Milwaukee team that's probably going to be feeding Giannis a lot more in the post. So I have Milwaukee over Boston. And in the Western Conference, I have Denver over Phoenix. Denver-Milwaukee is the finals, I think. Barring, again, a crazy run, I still think Denver just has enough. And with the altitude, as we all know, it's incredibly hard to play there. I have Denver winning in six.
Yeah. And that's where, again, so it may be a little more of a competitive run for Denver this year in the playoffs than last year, where it seemed like they really breezed through it. But again, let's remember back here between Michael Porter Jr. and especially Jamal Murray going down and not being in there the last couple of years. This is a Denver team that potentially could have been going for its third title in a row. So if you were wondering why they looked as dominant as they did, think back to the Bulls teams in the 90s, right? Like the 91 champs weren't as dominant as the teams that came afterwards. Denver's schedule for this, I think we'd call it a budding dynasty already. The schedule was a little bit off because by the time they won the title, they were finally as dominant as a team would normally be on its second or third run through. So I don't mean to say that it starts going the other way necessarily, but I do think, again, I think Denver's the favorite this year. I think all things being equal, Denver's the favorite in 2025. But I think we may be getting to that part of the slope where it kind of starts going the other way and they have to at least break a sweat, which it seemed like they rarely had to do in 2023.
Right. And one thing I will say this too, because I heard a lot of this from NBA Twitter and the Gram as well, about people discussing about the road to a title being easy and all that. But again, we always use this rule, Rick, and especially in sports, you only play the teams that are ahead of you.
Yeah.
So just because, you know, you had an easy pathway, can you blame them? And to be honest, too, you know, we both know this is going to probably be a harder run for Denver because they'll probably have to face an 8 seed similar to what Minnesota last year, where, yeah, if we're being brutally honest, Rick, Minnesota kind of gave away one of those games at home.
Sure.
So that series probably, if we're being honest, should have gone 6. And then they just ran into two really good matchups for them, essentially. So,
yeah.
Again, and I kind of feel like it's going to run into the same thing. And I think the big question for Denver, especially if it is a Denver-Phoenix finals, will they have enough offense at the end of the day to beat a Phoenix team if you have Durant and Booker and Bradley Beal as forefront?
That's a very open question. But again, the teams that are trying to run down Phoenix, or trying to run down Denver, like Phoenix and Boston, they somewhat kind of hollowed themselves out a little bit to do that. They got a little bit more top-heavy because you can't beat a team like Denver without a lot of star power. It is kind of the catch-22 situation here. And you look at it like, yeah, Denver, Minnesota in the first round. But again, if you're a team like Denver, you're not going to be playing a competitive 8 seed in the Western Conference. Like, that first round is going to be a gimme no matter who you're playing. From there, They had a relatively competitive series. Maybe, in fact, no, easily their most competitive series, and this isn't saying much, against Phoenix. They played the Lakers and blew them out. So if you're gonna, what are you gonna look at it and say? Oh, they'd have to play Golden State. Oh, the team that the Lakers blew out. Tell me that would have been any different if Golden State played Denver. They would have lost in 4 straight. And then yes, it is true that neither Milwaukee nor Boston made it through to the NBA Finals. Miami, we called it going in. We knew that it was going to be a Denver win going away. But I think I would have said the same thing if it was Boston or Milwaukee last year. So it's like the people that are making that criticism, I think it's a surface-level criticism because I don't think it holds up under scrutiny. Because if you look at what would have been the toughest possible path for them to the finals, I don't think it would have been much more tough than it was.
No, I think the only scenario, Rick, that would have made that much tougher is if they had to play Sacramento at some point.
Maybe. I mean, they had firepower. as we were saying, and again, it would have been a very, very exciting series. But in terms of, again, to the notion that teams, and it doesn't look this way sometimes. Because, again, you look especially at the advanced metrics last year, I think where the Cavs were top five in the league offensively and defensively. The Cavs had the look of a team that didn't need to lose before it won, and yet it happened anyways, largely because the fatal flaw turned out to be they're basically just defenses were collapsing on Mitchell and Garland because they didn't really trust anybody else to shoot the ball anywhere. They didn't believe that anybody could do that effectively. And then for Sacramento, it was just the whole playoff thing of matching up with Golden State. They weren't able to get through that series when it happened. So I hear you on this, that on the X's and O's, Denver and Phoenix would have been, or I'm sorry, Denver and Sacramento would have been fascinating. But by the same token, if it's a team that couldn't handle the pressure of getting past Golden State in that year, tell me that they would have really stood up to Denver's firepower. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. And I also think it's a point we make, too, that I feel like especially a lot of fans now have revisionist history in mind.
Yes, yes.
And I feel like that this is more prevalent now more than ever because I feel like a lot of NBA fans have this tendency to be team-focused and finding a way to discount championships. And it's just that's been going back ever since the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
But it's more prevalent now with the proliferation of social media and ways to discount champions at every sort of turn.
Yes.
But I do find it interesting that it was more of a conversation than in any other year than last year.
Absolutely. And again, and
kind of fascinating that Denver was the one that was nitpicked instead of some of the more recent titles that have occurred.
Yeah, I don't get that at all. I think it was just a thing where I think it was such a backlash to the fact that, again, Denver really, it's funny because, I mean, for a team that had a dominant regular season, for a team that had all the signs of going on to do what it did in the playoffs, it feels like as far as the national media went that they kind of snuck up, basically. And it was kind of a thing where, well, let's see what happens when they play this team. Let's see what happens when they play this team. And when Denver lived up to the hype and did that, I think there was just this reflexive stubbornness as far as giving them the credit that they deserved. And I think also, too, again, just to bring it all the way around here, that, again, what Denver and Miami really kind of, not necessarily started, because San Antonio was doing it as far back as the 90s and the 2000s. Of course, player development with Pop. That was how they built out the rest of that rotation for their championship teams over the years. But then again, Denver and Miami in recent years really sort of picking up the baton there. Now the entire league is having to do this, and the entire league is having to look at cost effectiveness for spots on their roster as this de facto hard cap is coming into play. And the way that the NBA Players Association really fumbled the bag in these negotiations, that tale will be told for decades because it has changed the course of the game and how championship teams are put together, and it makes it that much harder in the short run for anybody to be able to catch Denver because, you know, they're up against it, but what do they care? All their guys are still in their prime or in some cases approaching their prime. So, you know.
And we'll know too, Rick, a couple of those young guys like Christian Braun and Zeke Nagy have been with that franchise now two or three seasons, and I expect that both of those guys to play much bigger roles than in previous seasons.
Yeah. And I'll tell you
this.
And
they're both good players on top of that, so.
Yeah, and there's an interesting kind of spillover effect as well, because you and I were talking about this. The fact that the G League finally has 30 teams, that the NBA is finally treating the G League like it's a legitimate developmental arm after all this period of time, because it's having to. And you look at teams like Sioux City with what Miami does, and how the players that play for Sioux City learn the Heat system top to bottom. We're going to be seeing that replicated throughout the league with teams really being hands-on. The Cavs are one of the teams that's been doing this the last couple of years or so. I'll tell you, Ben, me and a couple of the homies, we're going to go out and catch probably a couple of Cleveland Charge games this year. I've never seen a G League game in my life. I've been to minor league baseball. I've been to minor league hockey. I've enjoyed those experiences. Basketball is finally now catching up to where these other sports have been, to where you can go there, and in the G League, you're not going to be seeing the future stars on your team in all likelihood, although a guy like Bates with the Cavs certainly has a lot of upside, but you're going to be seeing future rotation players. And if you're a hardcore fan, just seeing cost-effective future rotation players is exciting in and of itself.
And I think especially, too, there are a lot of people in today's basketball fandom that cannot afford to purchase an NBA ticket in most periods of time.
Yes.
So this is arguably the closest thing that they will get. And I'm very, you know, I've been proud to see the G League grow and how everything's been running, how everything's been going with under the stewardship of Sharif Abdul-Rahim. They've done a really good job of building everything up. And while it's still not, I would say, a secondary league that a lot of fans need to pay attention to closely, I think what they've done with G League Ignite has been incredibly impressive, and then just being able to see how many guys that have been in the G League and now have been on professional rosters has just been incredible.
Yes, they have done a very good job. You're right about that with Abdul-Rahim and the leadership of the league and the way that they really have kind of leveled up and to where it is now a legitimate experience. And it's another thing, too, don't discount the fact that in most cases, if you want to see them play, you got to go to the games. Like for me as a Cavs fan, I love watching the team on TV, and I'll watch it on my social devices, my mobile devices if I'm not in front of a TV. I like that experience. Having to go down there, like you said, the ticket prices and everything else like that. I love watching the Cavs on TV. I don't have the option to watch the Charge on TV, and you're absolutely right. It is a great experience that if you're feeling like, I don't know that I want to pay all of this and deal with all the traffic of all of that, it's the path less traveled to go to a G League game, and it can be more relaxing, but a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, and I think people also tend to forget, too, that, again, these games are also hyper-competitive.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot of guys who have played in the NBA. And, like, I mean, recently I know the Amazon Prime, I think it was last year, had the G League movie. I believe it was called Operation G League. And that spotlighted guys like Scoot Henderson and Denzel Valentine and Gabe York. So it was, the G League is very interesting. And especially now we're going to see NBA expansion coming up. And then we're also going to see, more G League teams added to the mix. So it's an opportunity to watch more professional basketball, especially for what we know is a very tough economy for a lot of people.
Yes, and one that, depending on...
Or scenarios, Rick, we'll use an analogy. There are some places where it's going to be complicated for you to go watch an NBA game.
Well, yeah. And depending on what you see and believe about the economy, it may not be getting much better in the next year, so... Yeah, it's a great alternative out there, and there's going to be more at stake than ever before when you watch G League games because there's going to be actual development happening on every roster out of necessity, and you're going to see players fighting for and gaining these precious rotation spots on the big clubs here. And again, I realize this only appeals to sort of the hardest core among those who are listening to us, but again, for somebody like me, for a basketball nerd like myself, the chance to see the cost-effective options for my Cavs, maybe the 8th, 9th, 10th guys in the rotation going forward here, that's an exciting thing. It's exciting to see a guy like Bates or Isaiah Mobley or somebody like that potentially be able to step up and grab one of those spots there. Potentially Craig Powell. I guess he's been turning a lot of heads in camp.
Right,
as well.
And one thing I will also note too, Rick, is that in a lot of comparison to a lot of sports, I would make the argument the NFL right now will probably see a scenario where they will team up with the newly merged USFL, XFL at some point to do sort of their own version of the G League. But the NBA is one of the very few sports that has a minor league that allows players to travel so freely with the 10-day contracts and all these other things. So it's going to be very interesting, and I'm intrigued to see the growth of the G League and how we'll start seeing, and again, too, it's also a developmental league, but it's also a testing ground. We saw stuff with, the Rio Grande Valley Vipers and the movement theories of, like, Daryl Morey and Chris Finch. So you're going to see a lot of, there's also the possibility to see some things that might be coming to the NBA level. And also opportunities, which I think will occur a little bit, too, is the G League might be a testing ground for more VR, AR, augmented reality stuff as well. So it's going to be very interesting for that side of the league moving forward.
Oh, that is a great and intriguing point that you just made, because I know that the NFL has used the XFL as a little bit of a breeding ground testing laboratory for some of their moves that they have been doing. So, yes, I think that very well could be the case. And baseball, I think, has used the Independent Atlantic League, I believe, for some of their moves in the past. I honestly think you could be seeing some of the same thing here. And I think, again, this is happening out of economic necessity because of the harsh realities of the new CBA. But I think the NBA is going to be looking at what comes out of this and kicking itself and going, why didn't we take the CBA this seriously years ago for player development? And I certainly think as well, for if it's anybody's first time at catching Ben Chu and myself doing a basketball segment here, hopefully I think you would be kicking yourself and saying, why didn't I do this before? And thankfully there's a healthy back archive to be able to go back on and catch up on our basketball conversations. But Ben Chu, always a pleasure, and I look forward to catching up with you subsequently as the season goes along. We'll be sure to talk some TV streaming as well here. That's another little interesting mini-series we've been doing on the show, and there have been some interesting developments in that, as there always are.
Yeah, and then obviously pertaining to this podcast, we also know the CBA is coming up in 2024, so we might see an NBA-exclusive streaming package coming to one of these streamers. So
yes, very possibly.
Or excuse me, an exclusive games package. There we go.
Yes, maybe like a Monday night.
They don't want anyone to like lose their mind there for a second.
Like a Monday night package. We've been talking about this possibly on Apple or Amazon or something like that. We both think that's going to be carved out. We'll have to see how it goes. We'll be keeping an eye on that as we go along. Once again, thank you so much, Ben Chu, for another great segment here. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1663.